Hi, listeners. So we were unable to record this episode in our usual way, so we use voice memos and Zoom, and that's why the sound quality might not be what you're used to from us. That being said, we had a blast recording with our two special guests, and we think you guys will have a blast listening to them. So hope you enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to the Untitled Female Driven Podcast. We are three film and television writers who are here to talk about how to make it as professional writers in the entertainment industry. This podcast covers what we wish we'd known when we were getting started, so you all can learn the easy way what we learned the hard way. I'm Erica Schreiber. I mostly write features.
I'm Jess Cho, and I mostly write for television.
And I'm Hannah Rosner. I also mostly write for television.
And today, we are actually the Untitled Children of Tendu-driven podcast because we have two very special guests and our very first menfolk, Jose Molina and Javier Grigio Marxwatch, otherwise known as the Children of Tendu.
And we are here to drive the podcast.
Yes.
Yes, yes.
Maybe we should have one more man every week and one of us leaves. And then when we're done, it will become the Untitled Male Driven Podcast. And then we'll get bought by a studio.
That's too 2022. It's too on brand for the world.
We fully expect to be kicked off of this podcast and then never asked again. So and then you'll have no more men in the podcast.
This will be a one-time deal. We're so excited to have you guys. This is so awesome of you to join us.
Javi, you have created and showrun The Middleman, worked on as a writer-producer on a little show called Lost, and among many, many other shows you worked on are The 100, Charlie's Angels, Medium, Cowboy Bebop. I'm just skipping a whole bunch. You guys can look them up. Just go to IMDb and look these two up. They've worked on a lot of stuff. And then Jose and I...
Hannah, yes. It's The 100.
The 100.
Not the
Did
100.
I say The 100?
It's The 100.
I almost wrote
Jose,
that out.
I was holding back, Jose.
You were so uncool for not knowing that.
I can correct somebody finally, and then you did it.
You guys are insulted. It's been lovely having you. Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks for everything, guys. You can go back to having the ladies on your podcast and no men. We're done.
We have men for 5 minutes and we already just fucked it up.
There's a man named Josh Applebaum, a very nice dude. He's one of the Midnight Radio guys, worked on Bebop or something. But he's famous for starting. He's the only person that I know of who's ever started a pitch with the word fucking.
Started like off the bat.
Apparently, this pitch is literally legendary. This pitch apparently took place in an episodic writer's room in the 90s. And like he might have been smoking a cigarette during it, the way that I heard it. But it literally started with "fucking." There's a truck. I mean, it was a show called Fastlane, apparently, and it's like legendary. I was hearing about it 8 years later. So there you go.
Oh, anyway. That's awesome.
This is great, Jose. I'm getting a view of your room. Our listeners cannot see this, but we're on Zoom, and now or your whole house. I've only ever seen your office when we were on Zoom for 6 months.
I had to run and get some water, so I just traveled for a minute.
But, you know, it's weird because, like, you get a lot of that now in the age of Zoom where people take their laptop and walk around their house, you know? And it's like that shot Spike Lee does whenever somebody's, like, really just in a bad mental state where, like, they're steady. But, you know, yeah. So it's like I literally just thought you were like Denzel Washington coming in to talk to the hostage takers in The Inside Man. It was literally exactly like that. Except you look nothing like Denzel Washington. Hey, look, Jose, we're in a podcast.
We didn't even let Hannah give my credits.
All right. Jose and I work together on Legacies, where he was a co-EP, and we got to write an episode together. It was super fun. It was a Western. And Jose's writing and producing credits include Firefly, Dark Angel, Vampire Diaries, Agent Carter, blah, 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 blah. Also look him up on IMDb. There's a lot of television that these two have worked on. Their careers have spanned over two decades in the TV and film industries, and we're so excited to have you guys on our podcast. We didn't just invite you two here for you guys to tell us all of your secrets to success. All three of us are big fans of your podcast. It's called The Children of Tendu, and it's an incredibly insightful educational series that teaches emerging writers how to navigate this crazy business with decency and integrity, which are values that we at the Untitled Female Driven Podcast hold in very high regard. There's so many names now. This is a crossover episode. It's very exciting.
I want to go on record as saying that the dazzle is all coming. I've never been dazzling. It's all Jose.
He's very dazzling. I can confirm. Our first question, how did you two meet?
You want to take this one or should
well,
I take
we,
this
we
one?
We met at a public hanging. That's a line from Kids in the Hall. I stole it from them. So here's what happened. So I went to elementary school with Jose's older brother, Juan Carlos. And wow. So I'm two years ahead of you if we were in school, right?
Yep.
And so I was living in California. I had come out for grad school and I'd just gotten this job at NBC. And Jose's mom was at the Pueblo supermarket in Torrimar, or maybe Garden Hills, and there she saw my aunt. Now, they had both grown together on the same, they had both grown up in the same street, along with also my mother and her family. And it was decided at that point that we were to be best friends. And I mean, it's Puerto Rican moms. You can't, I mean, like, I actually don't like Jose very much.
but you had no choice.
It was one of those arranged play dates. I mean, it literally was like my mom went to Javi's aunt and was like, what's Javi doing? Oh, he's in L.A. Oh, so Jose's in L.A. They should meet.
Did you know each other when you were
ordained.
When you were kids? No. Just you know of each other, but you okay? Wow, that's crazy.
I didn't even know of him. I just knew Juan Carlos. I didn't even know he existed. Did you know I existed?
No, I don't think so.
Okay,
so I went on a date with your cousin.
That's true.
I'm glad you know that.
I do. You know, and actually, weirdly enough, I saw her last weekend, and she says hello, and she said very nice things. So there you go.
That's adorable. Can you explain? Who is Tendu? Who are your parents that you are the children
What's
of?
What's a Tendu?
Well, first of all, we don't know if we're the children of Tendu or the audience is the children of Tendu, though. I guess it's sort of become the convention that you and I are the children of Tendu, right, Jose?
I guess. The name from the podcast stems directly from, there's a song called, an early 90s song called Counting Blue Cars by a band, One Hit Wonder by the name of Dishwalla. So that's the song that's like, tell me all your thoughts on God because I'm on my way to meet her, that song. So there's a line in that song where the singer says, we ask many questions like children often do. Oh. Me and Javi are gigantic Star Trek fans. So when I heard this lyric, I remember Javi and I would talk on the phone all the time. I'm like, hey, have you heard this song? I think it's like a science fiction song. There's something about the children of Tendu. And who are the children of Tendu? And the minute it comes out of my mouth, before Javi starts laughing at me, the minute it comes out of my mouth, I'm like, oh, it's children often do, not children of Tendu.
That's great.
But it became a running joke between us. And then when we were looking for a name for the podcast, the name we wanted, which was Cinema Cuatro, Cinema Four, which is the movie theater in the neighborhood where we grew up, was taken. So we were throwing around a couple of different names. And I suggested, you know, cementing my Mondegreen into the annals of history. And there you go.
You're very brave.
It's one of the things, like when Javi and I first started talking about doing the podcast, the ethos that I really wanted us to embrace was the ethos of the Craig Ferguson show, the late night with Craig Ferguson, which is a very sort of digressive, off the cuff, improv driven, laugh at your own mistakes kind of a show. And I thought it would be much more interesting for Javi and me to do a show that was like us talking like, you know, we're like you've heard us talk already today, digressively, randomly, stream of consciousness, and not sort of hewing to any real agenda other than, you know, we want to cover some topics, but we want to be goofy and we want to be silly. And so it seemed like Children of Tendu was starting the whole endeavor on something that was a mistake born out of me being a dummy seemed like a good way to go.
We started the podcast. We were at a bar on Ventura Boulevard getting drunk before a Dungeons and Dragons game.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I love everything about that sentence.
Yeah, right? And, you know, what happened was we started making a list of all of the sociopathic abusers we'd worked for. All of the, just the worst of the worst. And we started with the worst of the worst. And then there were more on the list and then more and then more and then more. And then we started to make a list of people that we thought were genuinely good managers and good, you know, human beings that we'd work for. And that list was significantly shorter. So we started talking about, well, how do you like get people who aren't very nice to be better, to be nicer? And we realized those guys are already wealthy. Nothing's going to stop them from being who they are or managing shows the way they are because the world's already validated what they do. So we realized that the best way of doing it would be to get them while they're young, you know? And that was really the impetus to start the podcast was we realized that there was a like void in education for screenwriters. And look, we also taught pretty much the podcast at the Writers Guild for a year. And I think the Writers Guild now is going to do some sort of more formal version of that sort of education. But it's one of those things where it just didn't exist. And we really, a lot of the stuff we said in the podcast just wasn't being said by anybody, because a lot of as scared and neurotic as Jose and I are, and as much as we go back over the podcast and be like, oh, let's take that out, let's take this out, we're very candid in it. And I just, and I think that we're, I know there's other podcasts about Hollywood. I'm not claiming the first at anything or whatever, but we just wanted to be able to speak candidly and to give real opinions from real people about what it's like when it's good and when it's bad, you know?
Well, I got to be honest about something. This morning I was listening to the 11 Laws of Showrunning episode, and I have this weird, I don't know if it comes from imposter syndrome mixed with anxiety or what my deal is, but I have always been actually weirdly reluctant to listen to screenwriting podcasts. And it's not that I don't want to learn. I absolutely do. I think it's that my anxiety is at the level that I'm like, well, they're going to say something on this podcast that I don't know or understand. And that's going to get me like spiraling and thinking about how unfit I am for this business. And so I just don't like listen to podcasts very often. It's a bad habit. I'm trying to get into getting over that.
This is why I don't read Deadline, by the way. Exactly what you described is why I don't read Deadline.
But you know how you're saying like it might be something I don't know? Like that's actually legit. Like I'm the same way, but it's because I fear that the people in the podcast are just better than me.
Right.
Yeah.
So you're actually doing great. Like your thing, you can get over your thing. I've got real issues.
that's also part of my issue.
My issues even real, or are my issues imposters too?
Your issues win. You have bigger issues. All right. You're right. But what I was going to say is that when I was listening to the episode, it was the first time I was like, I think I could be a showrunner someday. And sure, I've had that like dream and wish, but that was the first time I was like, they're actually making it sound like being a good person and a good manager of people and being a natural leader who wants to inspire people is part of the goal, much more so than the creative success of it. And it was sort of like, I just have to thank you guys for that episode, because really, genuinely, this morning was the first time I was like, maybe I could do that.
You absolutely can. And that's the thing that I find so, like there's this article that just came out on Vice about the crisis in showrunning, and how...
Yes, I read this and I read you in it.
I was in it. I was very excited about that. I gave that interview like 4 years ago. It's like, she's been working. That article is densely researched. There are a lot of people who are deeply invested in the idea of the auteur showrunner and the idea that showrunner is some mystical intangible, and that creativity is some mystical intangible. And the truth of the matter is, showrunning is management. It doesn't have to be this mystical thing, and it annoys me when people lean too much into the idea that it's some sort of creative magical thing that can't be possibly explained, because it's basically saying no one can do what I do, and that's bullshit. So honestly, I got so tired of being just abused, and the article is 20 years of my career, even though everybody I've worked for thinks it's just about them. But which by the way should tell you how common these neuroses are and these showrunner diseases are. I've suffered so much at the altar of other people's process, and it's really just my way of saying, shut the fuck up about your process. No one cares. Sit down and write.
Based off everything you guys have been saying about surviving at the altar of other people's, should we say, toxic personalities, you guys are titans of screenwriting in a way. Like all the credits that you guys listed, Dark Angel, I grew up on that television. It's part of the reasons that I became a television writer.
I honestly can't tell you how happy it makes me to hear that. I mean, it's, and look, some of the shows that I've worked on have been very difficult ones. When somebody mentions a show that I worked on that maybe wasn't that great a show, or just that you grew up watching the types of shows that I worked on, it really, it's very gratifying, because yes, during the 80s and 90s and the early aughts, and for a great deal of the history of television, television has been an unpleasant place for writers to work on because of a lot of these things. But when people say, I really liked X show, you can think, oh my God, that show was terrible to work on. But then you also go like, oh, it was worth it that I put up with all of that because somebody really liked it and maybe wanted to become a TV writer for it. That's a really kind compliment. And, I really appreciate it.
All three of us have discussed how much we feel that way. Like, we're all genre writers, and we all watched your shows.
It must be wonderful to be able to look back at your career and say like, oh yeah, my shows touch people in this way. But how do you survive it in the moment? Right? Because when you're doing it, there's no way to know in like 5, 10, 15 years if people are going to come up to you and say like, I love your show, and you realize that it's all worth it. Like, what is the thing that like motivates you and gets you through those particularly difficult rooms or experiences?
The truth of the matter is, like, we were talking a minute ago about how we're just kind of starting to realize that these shows at the beginning of our career meant something to somebody, and that people come up to us and go like, you know, I got into screenwriting because of this show or that show that we worked on that we had some small part of. The thing that keeps me going isn't that, because otherwise maybe I would have given it up a long time ago. The honest, no bullshit truth is what keeps me going is sheer and utter stubbornness. I get knocked down to the mat over and over and over again, and I refuse to stay down as much as I would want to stay down. If we're talking about giving advice here, sometimes a smart man stays the fuck down. John Rogers has a great saying, which is, know the difference between a challenge and a warning. When somebody kicks the shit out of you, you don't have to get up and get more of the shit more beat out of you. You can stay down. You can leave the ring. You know, this industry isn't something that's like the fucking mafia. They're not going to kill you if you leave. And the only person that's really going to perceive that you're a failure if you do leave is you. So one of the things that I've been thinking a lot about lately is like, you know, your own emotional well-being in the over the course of all this abuse and toxicity and difficulty. You know, you don't have to put up with it. There are other satisfying means of being creatively fulfilled. But you asked how have we gotten through the travails. And it really is stubbornness. It is the idea that I refuse to lose, that I refuse to stay down, that I refuse to let this motherfucker beat me, who put me on my back. There is a show that Hannah and Javi both will recognize, because I've told stories, that made me want to leave the industry. And I was like, maybe that's it. Maybe I'm out. Maybe I should just go. And a lot of the impetus for me to keep going was that I didn't want to feel like this showrunner had driven me out. I still have stories to tell. I still have work that I want to do. I have people I want to work with. Javi and I have never worked in a room together. That's one of my goals, is for one of us to get a fucking show on the air so that we can work with each other. So that's one of the things that keeps me going, is like, I will work with my best friend. And I will work with my other friends. And if I hang it up, then I'll never do that. So that's one of the things that keeps me going. And also the idea that per Javi's laws, like, I will be the kind of showrunner that is the paladin of those fucking laws. And working with me and for me will hopefully be a good environment for everybody. And I can create a tiny little space in Hollywood where people can be happy at their work and doing good work, good creative work, and going home with a smile on their face, which is what we all should be able to do.
I mean, it feels like, as an added bonus, like, you creating a wonderful work environment for everybody is the biggest fuck you could give to all the toxic people who ran toxic rooms.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, but don't underestimate the power of fuck you. I mean, it's really, it's actually the actual fuck you. I think that the film Ferris Bueller's Day Off is one of the most toxic and hateful racist documents of white middle class entitlement ever.
Racist now.
Dude, have you seen how many jokes about, like, minorities are in everything John Hughes ever wrote, especially even Ferris Bueller?
Sure.
Anyway, there is one thing in that movie that, like, actually inspired me, and it's exactly what Jose just said. What keeps you on the chair is your tyranny of will. And it's this feeling, it's, yes, I'm going to get busted someday, but not by him. So you need to, you know, you need to take care of yourself emotionally. Some say physically, I don't believe in that. But you have to have valves that where you can therapeutically, like, actually look at some of the stuff you go through. And it's not even bad show running or whatever. It's like, you know what, being a storyteller can be emotionally very draining, because you are constantly seeking, you know, it's funny. So Jose and I, when Jose quit Law and Order, can I tell the story? When after Jose left SVU, I remember asking Jose, why did you leave SVU? That shows a license to print money. And Jose, you know, and I had written an SVU, so I understood this, but I had never been on staff. He'd been there for, like, what, 3 years you were on that show?
3 years, yeah.
Yeah. So Jose says to me, I can't believe I'm telling your war stories, but it's kind of my story because I was there. So it does make sense. So Jose says to me, well, you know, like, it's really hard having all that, you know, be constantly being looking for ways to blah, 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 to rape people and all this stuff. And I think I peaked when I sodomized someone with a violin bow. And I said, okay. So, I mean, can you imagine, like, your life is sitting in a room and coming up with, like, the worst case scenario for every situation? Yeah.
The worst thing that one human being can do to another, that's that job. And it's the job of, like, you know, special victims are victims of sexual assault, the elderly and children. So these are the people that week in and week out you are putting through the ringer. And so, I mean, there was another episode that I did where I very proudly came up with a way for a mass murderer of children to identify which mementos belong to which children. And that was by smelling the baby shampoo on the baseball hats. And my showrunner loved it because that's the kind of ghoulish shit that show does. And I'm going like, yay, success for me, but I gotta get the fuck out.
That's such a good point, is, you know, people, that's what, it's a beloved show, and people, the difference between watching it and, you know, you can like, oh yeah, and then it goes in your brain and it goes back out again. But when you are the one creating it, I see why that would stick in your head so much more.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wrote the episode where Zach from Saved by the Bell was infamously raped in an alley. And wow, that was like one of the hardest months ever, just like literally just being in that world of, so 3 years, this guy's much tougher. Jose is much tougher than I am.
I really like how you said, you know, like, you don't have to do this, right? You don't have to be in this industry. You don't have, if this is not working for you, blah, blah. But for those of us who want to stay in the industry, when you are knocked down, how do you kind of determine which issues are worth standing back up for, or and which are just worth collecting yourself and moving on to the next time you'll get knocked down? Like, how do you kind of differentiate when it's worth it to fight and when it's worth it to move on?
Strategically retreat.
Yeah.
Well, it's a really simple question. Do you have a mortgage?
Sorry, we're millennials. We don't have houses. Like, that's not
right.
Well, no, but we have. No, but you have an apartment. You've got rent. You've got. Look, I actually had this conversation with somebody who was offered a job on a show that I had been on. That was a notoriously difficult show, and that person said, "You know, should I take the job?" And my question was, "Do you have a mortgage?" Because a lot of the times you have to tough it out, not because of your emotional well-being, you have to tough it out because you've got a life and you've got, you know, maybe children or a partner or whatever responsibilities you have. You know, I have two kids, I have a house, I have an elderly father-in-law that I'm taking care of. You know, I can't just jumpstart my life today. You know, if I wanted to change my life, it would be a process of several years that I would have to kind of figure out what I would do, all the financial stuff, you know, and all of that. So like, whether you take a job or not, like, you, the financial exigencies of the immediate moment and whether you stay in a job are certainly that. And if that's the case, then you have to do other things like try to detach yourself emotionally from the job. Apropos of what you're saying, I don't know about when to retreat because I've never been good at retreating. I literally just lead face first into the punch, you know, and honestly, to my great detriment. And
You wind up on your ass, which is the same thing. Yeah, I do.
I did a pilot with a very, 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 very famous producer of feature films. Okay. And this guy fucked my dreams over from left, you know, from just every place, okay? And like, the pilot was never going to go. It was terrible. It was terrible because of a lot of bad decisions this guy made for me that I had to go along with. And it was also terrible because of a bunch of bad decisions I made. But honestly, most of it was on him. But here's the thing. So I should have, I got kicked out of the editing room on my own show because I wasn't having it. I wasn't having the things this guy wanted on screen, right? And I went home. And I had that Ferris Bueller moment where I literally went, not by him. And I had been a network executive only a few years before. That was my first job. I marshaled all of the forces that I could before me. I forced my way into the editing room with a vice president of the network that commissioned the show. And I got all the shit put back on the pilot. Do you know what happened? The pilot didn't get picked up. And I was blacklisted from that studio for 12 years. In the real world, Ferris Bueller gets shot in the head for hijacking a parade float. You know, it's not him singing Twist and Shout. It's like, no, Homeland Security fucking takes him out, yeah. You know? And when you think about that, like, so you need to be able to dive. If you're in an uncomfortable situation that you have to ride out for financial or personal reasons, it just becomes about what you do outside of the job. And I find that whenever I feel like shit, I do something for somebody else.
And I think that's absolutely right. Getting out of your own little sea of troubles and doing something for somebody else is always a good solution to what ails you. What I was gonna say about the sort of exigency of a situation and do you have a mortgage, and is the business part of the business forcing you to do something you don't want to do. We all know, and if we don't, we should learn that when the getting's good, you should save your money. You shouldn't be, you know, taking luxury trips to with Elon Musk up to space, for instance, anything like that. you always have a nest egg, I think, is a wise thing to always keep in mind. And I think for me, one of the reasons why I have been able to quit some shows and why I've been able to weather being fired from some shows is that, you know, the house that I live in is the house that SVU built. And SVU, despite all of the issues that I had while writing on it, paid very well. And it allowed me to build a little bit of a cushion so that when I needed to go for my own sanity without work for 4, 6, 8 months without work, I could do it. So if you're in a situation where the getting's good, you know, invest in a house, use your money. Don't be Scrooge McDuck and hoard it, but always give yourself a little bit of an exit strategy. And that exit strategy, you know, should include, what do I live on if the getting, if for instance, a pandemic hits and I can't work for a year? And that can allow you to sort of do things that are where you're following your heart rather than following the grim realities of the business side of the business.
Yeah, being good with money makes you more powerful.
It always comes down to art versus commerce, and that's just the nature of show business. It's in the term show business. You half of it is the art, and half of it is the commerce. And you will find yourself often having to make decisions based on money when what you want to do is make decisions based on art. And the more that you sort of prepare for the inevitable day when you're gonna have to make that decision, the more you empower yourself, the more that yesterday you empowers today you to make those decisions, the happier you'll be.
I think also that there's also something to be said about due diligence. Most of the years of my career, I've had one offer and I've said yes and I've taken it and I've worked, you know, but it's not like I've had competing offers and millions of people wanting my services and crap like that. I mean, you sort of cobble together every yes until 27 years later, it looks like you're a titan. A big part of it is doing your due diligence. And some jobs you can't say no to, you know, but a lot of them you can. If you are lucky enough to have more than one possibility, then you talk to people who've actually worked with that showrunner and all of that, and see, you know. And if you only have one offer, then at least talk to other people so that you know what you're getting into, because it's better to not be surprised than to be surprised. It's better to know things about the people you're working with, even if they're negative. And if you're, you know, in the later part of your career and you're like where Jose and I are at, where you're a co-EP or an EP and you're taking these kinds of jobs. And I have to tell you, the most miserable times of my career have one thing in common. And they are all the times when they said, you can pair up with this person and there's a potential for great success. And I went out and talked to people, or not even talked to people. I just knew this person was like a horrible human being. And I said, and I looked at the success and I said, I can handle that person. Whenever you say to yourself, "Ooh, I can handle that person," you can't. Don't run. Like literally, it's like, you know, there's a reason people have bad reputations. And if you go out and find out what those reputations are before you sign on for the job, then at least you know what you're getting into. And if you have the ability to not take the job and you find out somebody's at, don't ever let the possibility of, but I'm going to make $1 billion sway you. Like, it's going to be miserable. Every time I've said I can handle him, I've gotten effed over.
That's John Rogers' challenge versus warning in a nutshell. If you know that producer X is a piece of shit who crucifies writers for fun, that's a warning. That's not a challenge. That's not go get him. That's run away.
It really shows you. I mean, you guys know most people by this point, you know, and for people just breaking in who don't know anyone, I think, I think Twitter is a valuable resource, but just working hard to network, you know, is one of the most important things so that you can know these things before you jump in with both feet. And yeah, like we say at the beginning, learning the easy way instead of the hard way as much as possible so that you can survive longer and get the jobs that will make you happy.
I know that what I'm about to say is not entirely germane to this, but it's something you just sparked. The thing about surviving as a writer, there's this delusion that we have to suffer in order to be good, you know, and I talk about that a lot in everything I've done. It's like, you know, like the idea that you have to cling to your darkness and all of that. The hardest lesson I had to learn, and I'm so happy I learned it when I did, is that you never turn down easy when easy shows up. You break something on a board and it breaks in 3 days instead of 2 weeks. That doesn't mean it's bad. That means you're good at this. You know, you write a script And it's easy because you're just taking shots you've already made and you know how to make the shots, and then you combine it together in a way that's kind of cool and it doesn't look like shit you've done, but it's just kind of been smooth. You don't stop and say, well, that must be because I'm a fraud.
Yeah, take the win.
Yeah, you take the win and take all the wins you get and learn to savor them, because the wins and the easy ones are the ones that carry you through that. Like, you know, some earlier in our careers, you know, when a show was a 1 year to 2 year to 3 year affair, you know, it's the one good experience could carry you through 2 years of hell.
You know? If you could go back in time, there's a time machine. You have a hot tub time machine. And you go back and you're meeting your younger selves who are just starting out in screenwriting. What is the one thing you would tell them?
It's funny. I've heard this question before, and I don't have like the super zingy, like, oh, that's so clever and smart and insightful answer. Because the honest answer is younger me wouldn't have listened to older me. Younger me knew abso-fucking-lutely everything. So what I would say is, you don't know everything, dummy. Open your ears, open your eyes, and learn from people that know more than you, rather than having to take all the punches right to the nose. It took me a long time to learn a lot of the lessons that I learned, and that's why when Javi and I first talked about doing our podcast, it was like, it would be great if somebody had told me X, Y, and Z, so that I didn't have to learn it on my own. Again, I don't know that I would necessarily listen, because I was a cocky little shit when I was coming up.
I found you delightful.
We fought about everything. I don't know how we even remained friends.
Well, you guys thoroughly stuck it out, so it must have been
something.
Yeah,
no, we did. We're okay. If I had to say something to my younger self, and Jose's rules apply, I don't think I would have listened. And I think the best lesson I can give anybody is, do not go into a writer's room hoping to get the love and attention you didn't get from your mother, your father, or your brother who you always, you know, idolized. Just don't. Showrunners are not, first of all, it's not part of their job to give you that. So that's not a function of showrunners being evil or mean or what. It's literally not their job. I think that a great deal of my own disaffection with the business comes from feeling personally disappointed by people that I wanted to be better. That doesn't mitigate some of the shit they pulled or all of the shit they pulled, but it does on the feedback loop. Then my reception of it and how I've dealt with it in life has often gone on longer and been more painful, because I had expectations, you know, familial expectations that weren't met, and workplace is no place for your familial expectations to be met.
That's really good advice. I think people do that really unintentionally.
That really applies to all relationships, and especially like personal relationships. If you're looking for someone to cure the wounds inflicted on you in your childhood, you're bound to be disappointed and you're putting too much on them. So I think what we're saying is, in general, you shouldn't be looking for outside validation from your employment, but also from like your creative life. It's hard not to, I think, when you're starting out, because writing and art is so personal. It's like you are putting yourself so out there, and it feels like you have to care enough to make something great and to put your heart and soul into something, but not so much that you're disappointed when it inevitably isn't the experience that you were hoping for. So it's kind of like raising a child, sending it off to kindergarten and waving goodbye, and then never picking your child up. Like, you're never seeing that kid again. You know, it's just like, you got to be like, okay.
The thought has crossed my mind, but I'm not going to talk about it. You know, it's interesting you should say that, because it is hard, and it's going to be hard even, but you can't unhear what I just said, okay? So the thing is, it's not that it's easy to divest yourself of your emotional need from the creative person who's been at it longer than you, whose shows you may have watched and loved, and who, you know, but if you at least have the seed of knowing that this person's not on the hook that way, you might be able to appreciate some other part of what they do, hopefully well. The best advice I ever got on relationships is actually also a really good piece of advice for how to deal with a boss or with a job or whatever. And it's this: know what they're good at. You know, if you're in a relationship with somebody, you know what they're good at, you won't be disappointed, you know? And to me, that's, and it's the same in a show. It's the same with bosses, everything. It's like, if you observe that person, you do some due diligence, if you know what not to expect, you won't be caught off guards having expected it, you know?
Yeah. The flip side of that makes sense too. Know what they're not good at, you know, as much as you can. Like, you can start working with someone or dating someone or whatever, you're going to get familiar with. No one wants people to know what their weaknesses are, but when you're stuck in a room with them for a long period of time, you're going to learn, and you should pay attention and listen when they tell you who they are.
My wife is a deeply empathic person. And every time I go to her with some, like every time I want to have like a misery party where it's going to be like, this person's a butthole, I fucking hate them. She goes like, yeah, but you have to think about what it was like when they did this thing. And then that happened to them. And then that must have really hurt them in this way. And I'm like, you're not giving me what I need from this marriage. And then I call Jose.
That's what I'm here for. That motherfucker said what?
Yes, everyone should have a Jose to vent to.
I feel like, you know, the Obama anger translator.
Yes, I love that.
Skit from Key and Peele, except that neither of us is Obama. We are already angry when we call the other, and then the other just sort of amplifies that anger times 10.
So you don't have to worry about making a call and like bringing someone down with your negative energy. You're like, they're going to be in that place.
They're going to meet me there already.
They're already there.
Yeah, we're not the anger translator. We're more like the anger preamp and subwoofer.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to get angry about in this industry, and that's something I struggle with a little bit, is when I feel that angry, what to do with it. And yes, I call Hannah or Jess sometimes or whatever, but also, like, you know, just being able to deal with it on your own is, I think, something you can only get better with as you experience it with practice.
It frees up so much more of your creative energy to do the things that you really do want to do, which is write and create television shows and develop stuff, when you're not spending all this time ruminating over this, you know, person that you can't change and you can't do anything about. It can be really nice to get to a point of, I don't really need to agonize over this relationship or this job, because I can just focus on, like you said, Erica, earlier, what I can control. And that's the work that you do.
I don't measure my mental health by the length of my periods of agony. I measure it by the length of time in between episodes, you know, and the longer the time between episodes, then, you know, that's how much more longer you can get now, you know. And you just, you know, I think that the idea of closure and catharsis and freedom from pain and from things that may have happened to you, that, you know, I don't believe in closure that way. I think that it's about managing the good times so they last as long as they can, and trying to manage the bad ones so that they don't.
Well, I had a question that was sort of around this topic. At what stage did you two feel like was the biggest hurdle to overcome? Think back to, you know, when you were first starting out, or was it more when you were trying to bump up from lower to mid-level? Was it trying to get to co-EP level, or was it all just easy? Was it just, you know, it all just worked out perfectly?
Well, I mean, of course it was easy. We are white.
Right. Exactly. And you're men. That's why we asked you on this podcast. Tell us, how do you know, white saying, men?
You know, I would actually say that the hardest, it's the hardest is getting your show on the air. And, you know, part of this is I have been lucky in that I got into the industry at a time where it wasn't the Wild West that it is right now. So my career looked like careers have looked like for, or did look like for 50 years, where I started as a staff writer and I rose up the ladder to story editor, exec story editor, on and on. And I did 22 episode seasons for the most part for the first decade of my career. And that got me up to co-EP and got me, you know, which you needed to be once upon a time to try to sell a show. And then, you know, I sold my first pilot when I was co-EP, my first year at co-EP, and then have been trying to get the ball through the hoop ever since. And that, you know, we're talking 15 years ago, I sold my first pilot, and I've been trying to get a show made and on the air ever since, and I haven't been able to. And, you know, Javi, correct me if I'm wrong, Javi, you sold your first pilot, Van Helsing, in like 97?
96.
And Middleman is the one that you were able to get on the air.
2007.
For me, it's hands down the hardest, because you also do the most free work that is the most hard on the sleeve. You're putting your most of your hopes into this one little basket and all your dreams, and you're like, this is the one, this is going to make it, this is the one that is the song of my soul, this is the one that is going to be the answer to all my prayers. And then inevitably the Monty Python gods drop a giant foot on your dreams. And that's the end of that. So that, I would say, has been the hardest part of the mountain to climb for me.
That is absolutely accurate. I think the hardest part of the mountain for all of us at any level may just be the next 10 years. TV has gone from being someplace where if you got the job, you know, you do at least 13 episodes and you would get enough money to have a living, you know. We're now doing these mini rooms where they pay you scale or they unbundle your producing fees from your writing fees. So like if they don't take you to set, you're only getting paid weekly for the writing and not for the producing. You know, you have these 8-episode orders so that you're working for, you know, 14 to 22 weeks at a time. So you're literally, you know, to make the kind of living that Jose and I were making 8 years ago, you're not just thinking about the job you have now. You're thinking about the next job and the next job after that. The amount of, you know, for somebody in my position right now, I'm lucky in that, you know, I'm fairly well known and what I bring to the table is sort of understood. So staffing jobs, you know, are a little bit smoother to kind of get, though by no means easy. There's a tremendous amount of competition. You know, on the development side, I have to have 4 projects at any given moment, just in the hope that one of them will at least get bought as a script so that I can make enough money to pay the mortgage. And I have to be thinking about where I'm going to staff after these 6 months are up and the next 6 months and the next 6 months. The margins are getting a lot tighter financially. I think if you're starting now, it's the hardest it's ever been to break in. It's the hardest it's ever been to get experience that'll make you a good showrunner or a showrunner or even somebody who can write a decent pilot. So I think we have some pretty rough waters ahead in the TV industry for everyone. It's not like some of us got rich and got on the space arc and we're flying off to the promised land. I think if your name isn't Ryan Murphy or Shonda Rhimes and, you know, like you didn't already get the $300 million Netflix deal, which they're never going to make again with anybody because they've realized, oh my God, our model was unsustainable. Oh shit. You know, I think if you're not one of those people, we're all in a very similar boat.
Well, that is very depressing.
Can I add, but I'll tell you another thing. And it's not as depressing. When you said hurdle, here's the one that I thought, you know, Jose was very candidly spoke about the business side of it. When I left Lost, you know, that show was such a roller coaster and there was so much fame and everything involved. And it was a really amazing time and it had a lot of challenges too. And when I walked out of that show, I was going to work on Medium and, you know, Glenn Caron, who ran Medium, also created Moonlighting. He's somebody that I was extraordinarily had a tremendous amount of respect for as a writer. And he's also somebody that I knew from due diligence to be a very tough grader. And I knew that I was heading into a place where the judgments would be severe, as any showrunner has the right to be. But I remember after everything that went on and Lost and all of the just, you know, all of the roller coaster of it and just the amount of time I've been in the business, I walked out of that show and I said, you know what? Code of the Samurai from now on, like it's done. It's like nobody can tell me I can't write anymore. Somebody can tell me I can't write their show. But after this, this experience of this amount of like just sort of validation, fame and the show doing what it did and having the influence, I will never be told by anybody that I can't write because the evidence clearly shows otherwise.
That's awesome.
By the way, I started my writing career in 1995. Lost was 2006. So that's how long it took to get there.
I really appreciate how candid you guys have been and how candid you are on your podcast. It's really helpful. I mean, that's kind of why we started our podcast as well, is to demystify this shroud of fog that is over everything, not just the way that the business operates, but also how feelings are involved in this whole crazy mess that we're all living in. But I did want to ask, when it gets so tough, because it sounds like the next 10 years are going to be tough. We know, because we talk about this on the podcast all the time, how hard it is to break in or to get that next job. Everything is hard. It's a super hard job and it never gets easier, which is not necessarily as depressing as it sounds. What do you guys find, though, makes it all worth it?
Nothing compares to being on set and seeing the words that you wrote actually coming to life, and especially when they get better on stage. There was a very clear moment that I remember in my head going all the way back to Firefly.
Oh, I thought you were going to say it was our Legacies episode, Jose.
You went.
That's true.
No, you went to Atlanta. I had to stay.
I got all the glory.
So there was a moment where we were shooting my second episode of Firefly, which I co-wrote with Ben Edlund, and Ben and I are standing at Video Village, which is inside the cargo hold of the spaceship. And outside, there are two guys with six guns shooting at each other. And I just looked at him and I was like, we are standing on a spaceship. And outside, there are guys with six guns shooting at each other. What the fuck did we do to get here? Because we did something right. When it's great, man, there is nothing better. It's just such a funny, incomparable feeling that there's literally nothing like it that I've experienced in the world. It's, you know, the thing that was a flight of fancy in your head is now something that 100 people have bent over backwards to make a reality. It's fucking awesome when it's great.
Yeah. I mean, look, what's every kid's dream? To run off and join the circus. We ran off and joined the circus, and we didn't want to be like the people who didn't run off and join the circus. You know, we are carny folk. We are nomadic. We have great insecurity in pretty much every facet of our lives, but we're at the circus. You know, I may be a clown, but I joined the circus.
Hopefully this isn't Nightmare Alley. We're all going to.
No, have you ever heard the joke? There's a guy who runs off to join the circus. He gets in touch with his parents, says, the circus is coming to town. Come see me at the circus, you know? And the parents go to the circus and they're watching the show, trying to figure out where their kid is. And then like the elephant act comes out and, you know, there's the guy with the broom cleaning the elephant dung, and that's their kid. And they're just heartbroken. And like at the end of the circus, they go to him and they say, dude, you can't do this. You have to leave the circus. And their son looks at them and says, and quit showbiz.
Amazing.
Awesome.
It's so funny that when I tell that joke, it takes me like 5 minutes.
Jose and Javi, you guys were wonderful guests. We're so glad to have had both of you. To our listeners, thank you for listening and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @untitledfemale, and you can connect with us there or email us at untitledfemaledrivenpodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. And also, if you guys haven't checked out The Children of Tendu, please do. All right. Thank you guys so much. Bye.
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 Thank you guys.
Thank you.